All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are live. Welcome everybody to a very interesting show and a delayed show. We were supposed to do this like a week and a half ago, almost 2 weeks ago. Unfortunately, we had some technical problems because we're all bad with technology here. Maybe not Lana. Maybe Lana's a little bit of ahead of us, but the rest of us are terrible with technology. So we finally got set up and we're good to go. Today's going to be a Ursula Haverbeck Memorial Stream, and we have a lovely round table of ladies who speak on these subjects, much like Ursula did. So I think it's very fitting that we have these women on today. So we'll go around really quick here, and we'll just introduce everybody, and then we'll kind of get into the topic. So we'll start with Lana, if you want to kind of introduce yourself for the audience, and then we'll kick around.
Sure, I'm Lana. I'm from Red Ice. My husband and I have been producing media. Oh, geez. He started around 2001, I think. Yeah. And then we started doing videos together around 2012 or something, or a little before that. So we've been hitting it hard. Our background is talking about anything, any kind of alternative research, ancient civilizations, conspiracies, basically nothing is off the table. And then more recently, we got involved in talking about politics and culture and where trends are heading. And the rest is history. Here we are.
All right. I was 3 years old when your husband started doing videos for Framework. It's very interesting.
It's great. You're ahead. You're
good,
ahead.
good. I'm
I
very
like
happy to
that.
be.
Yeah.
Monica, we'll go to you next. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm Monica Schaefer, and I guess I became infamous. That's how most people see it when I released my short video called Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust. That was in 2016. And my brother Alfred Schaefer and I, we kind of work as a team. I had been visiting him in Germany. I live in Canada, just to clarify that. And when I made that video, and then a year and a half later, I ended up in jail in Germany. I had gone back to visit him. I ended up being arrested. And then Alfred was also put in jail for a lot longer than myself. He spent 4.5 years in total in jail in Germany. And I was released on time served after 10 months. And I've been really working hard ever since, trying to help other people to wake up to what is going on in the world. The central issue, I guess, is the one that's in the title of that video that got me into trouble, the Holocaust. To me, that still is the linchpin lie under which Jewish power is pinned on that lie. I feel, and of course, I talk about current issues as well as things are happening very fast. So that's my basic story. Now, Zach, I had asked you if I could do a brief introduction of Michelle before she gives her own introduction, if I may proceed with that. So I met Lady Michelle Renouf in 2017, it was 2 weeks before I ended up in jail. So this was in Germany at a lovely house in Germany that Lady Michelle had a gathering at. And it was a winter solstice gathering. It was lovely. I met wonderful people there. And this was following a year and a half of ritual defamation that I had experienced in Jasper. So suddenly to be amongst all these people who actually appreciated me for what I had done instead of spitting on me literally or giving me death threats and all this treatment I had received. So it was like I had just gone into paradise, really. And so that was my first encounter with the lovely Lady Michelle. And I always say lovely on the inside and outside. And I know that for people who don't know what Lady Michelle has done, she has done a lot of work over the years. I think she was wide awake and aware of things long before I was. One example was the conference in Iran in, I think, 2006 or eight, six. Where you spoke, you gave a speech there, and it was a stunning short, 10 minute. I think you are the world's expert on these 10 minute speeches because you did another one that was just blew everybody away in Dresden a number of years later, from which you got
that.
Into some trouble. And that was impromptu. So anyway, I think that there were more things I wanted to say, but at this moment they escaped my mind. And so now over to you, Michelle, to do your own introduction.
Well, thank you, Monica, and it's great to see you all. And thank you for the invitation, Zach. It's a really nice opportunity to be with these two magnificent women and to speak of all the other women that we know, and most especially, of course, Ursula Haverbeck. But just, I think in the first instance, perhaps the best thing I can do is to explain to our viewers how I lack a certain bias, which I think is rather important, because I was not raised with any interest in any possible German ancestry. So whilst Monica and Zundel and Ursula herself will say that they do their work certainly for the honor of Germany, I cannot say that that was at all my impetus, you see. And I think that's rather an important aspect, and I don't speak German, alas. And also, not to speak too much of my own background, but rather importantly, to understand how I am so politically unworldly up until 2000, because I was raised from age 3 to 23. My whole life was devoted to the classical ballet, because my mother designed and made ballet costumes, and she was obsessed with my ballet training. So I never went to school for more than 3.5 or 4 days a week until I matriculated. And so the idea of ballet is to be unworldly, and I certainly was unworldly. And I think it's rather important to understand why I was so ignorant, and why it wasn't until 2000 when I read in the Times newspaper in London about a David Irving, whom I'd never heard before, and I'd never taken any interested in the Holocaust or World War II in particular, although I'd seen the films and so on, and assumed that the films were giving us an accurate record, as it were. But he had been quoted in the Times newspaper as saying, if he were a Jew now, he would not be asking who pulled the trigger, but why. And because I had written a monograph on Wagner and Judaism, I thought, I am asked the question why. In my monograph, I only referred to a question of saying, if you're going to call something a Holocaust, which is a sacrificial burnt offering, someone has to have offered it. And my only query was, who offered it? I never queried any other aspect. But I thought, he's asking a question that I often answer, although I think he must be nuts, because we've all been in the gas chambers. We've all experienced, you know, what we think took place, and it all makes sense, you know, emotionally at least. So I went along to the High Court in London in 2000 to hear what this crackpot had to say. And I found the very opposite of what I had been led to expect and did expect. I saw on the left-hand side of the court, a very small room, by the way, always, we are, these court cases where I've attended with Ursula Haverbeck have always been in the smallest possible courtroom, the same for Monica. But when the judgment comes, we are then in the biggest room that they have, you see. So they keep the public at bay, they keep the public out from hearing what is being said, and then when the judgment comes, then of course we have plenty of room for the public. So I went along there, but it was very difficult to get inside this room, which of course was full of the usual people interested. And so I was queuing in the canteen in the High Court one lunchtime, and David Irving happened to be behind me. He said, oh, I recognize you from attending my court hearings. What did you think of this morning's session? I said, well, I couldn't get in. He said, well, you can see that my benches are completely empty. because everybody was terrified of being anywhere near him. And he said, if you like, you can always take a seat in my benches, my empty benches, because he was his own barrister. He conducted his own case in the trial. So, of course, I was able to get a seat every day for the next 2 months because I became fascinated with the opposite of what I had been learned to expect, that he was simply being insulted whilst he himself was providing the documentary evidence. So, and it's worth mentioning to you just so that you understand how fearful it was for people to be seen near him, which of course didn't bother me one way or the other. There was a person there who Irving was chastising because he said, you'd promised to help me bring in my documents when I got out of the taxi and you let me down. And this person that I didn't know and didn't know me, because I happened to be just standing by, he turned to me and said, doesn't he realize that if I'm seen to bring in his documents or help him in any way, I will lose my job, my reputation, and so on. So it was Professor Arthur Butts, some of your viewers, I hope, will know of his book, The Hoax of the 20th Century, which is still very relevant today. He said when he saw the film Denial that they had made of Irving's trial, which of course is the literary reverse of what took place, Dr. Butt said, was that your kamikaze leap into revisionism? And so I guess that is what we have all done. We have made a kamikaze leap when we take an interest in the exceptionalism that is being allowed on one area of history. And so you go to prison in 20 countries, including Israel, if you dare query, as Ursula has done, in a civil and civic manner, the forensics involved in the murder of one person, let alone 6 million. She has asked that the Jewish federations of various sorts a simple question. Where is the evidence? Where did the crime take place precisely? And where is the evidence which is left behind? When there's a murder, there is an evidence of that murder, either as a body or as ash or whatever. And this is the kind of question that Ursula Habibek asked. And this is the kind of thing that I heard in David Irving's trial. And it was only from 2000 that I began to take an interest in what we all need to take an interest in, because it seems to me that even Donald Trump is afraid to cross these people who seem to have a colossal ability to create fear. They've been doing it for 2 millennia, and still this fear is there. And
they're starting
I came across
to
it even last night.
I think,
and I suppose just to sort of conclude a little bit of who in the world I am, I self-identify as a merely the advertising model, because I've been involved in advertising since birth, as a matter of fact, as a photographic and television commercials actress, and it's amazing how my career, strangely as it could seem, is so very relevant to what we're going to talk about, because I've been a propaganda tool all of my life without realizing this. And perhaps it's worth saying that our viewers in America, Canada, and Australia would have seen me in commercials for British Airways and Capital One credit cards, in Holland for Heinz curry sauce, in Germany for Chivo coffee, in Japan for Nissan cars and Nescafe, and so on and so on. So our viewers probably would have seen me somewhere in the world. and that is the strange and unbiased background that I bring to the table that we're talking about now. And I take it from there. You let me know what you might like me to talk about in relation, because I knew Ursula Habibek personally. I'd stayed at her home. I'd attended her trials. And of course, she was a dear friend as well as a role model and someone that is eternal, really, for us all, as a magnificent, fabulous woman, and now a legend internationally.
Certainly so, and I think one of the most important pieces about somebody like Ursula, or all of you ladies here, exposing this problem of the Holocaust, it is much harder for the media to take a sweet old lady figure like Ursula Haverbeck and turn her into this hateful, you know, white supremacist neo-Nazi. You know, it's really simple to take a brazen young man who might have a bald head and say, oh, this guy, you know, he's hateful, he just wants to kill people, and he's crazy. But when they see these, quite frankly, cultured women who are very enthusiastic, have a very feminine nature to them, explaining this problem, it's very hard to view that as some kind of hateful source. So actually, in light of that, and Michelle, you kind of did do so already, why don't we circle back around and maybe hear how each of you came to understand that the Holocaust narrative that you had shoved down your throat as a child was actually not true. Let's actually, we'll hop in the reverse, and Michelle already kind of really gave us a beautiful start. So let's go to Monica, and then we'll go to Lana, and then we'll circle back to maybe hear some about Ursula Haverbeck and your experience with her as well.
Okay, so, and just to segue from what Michelle said just now about being in the advertising business, that is so relevant, like you say, Michelle, because it all has to do with the art of persuasion. And so you already came into it with this ingrained knowledge of how does that work? How does the art of persuasion work?
And mispackaging. And mispackaging.
Yes, indeed. Oh my goodness, I could talk reams about that, just about the Green Party itself, which I was involved in. But anyway, back to your question there, Zach, how did I come to understand that the Holocaust was not as it was presented to us all our lives? It was after I had woken up about 9/11, and that was 10 years after 9/11, and then within the next couple of years, it took me a while to actually dare to look into the Holocaust after being fully cognizant that they lied to us about 9/11, and then I start to hear that, oh, the Holocaust, that didn't happen. And I thought, no, wait, that's too big. I can't go down that road. It took me a little while to get the courage to actually look into it. But once I did look into it, and I do believe that was in maybe late 2012 and early 2013, once I did dare to look, it didn't take long, because I'd already become cognizant that they lie to us about big things, and that was with 9/11. And that one really was hard for me to digest. It made me feel sick, actually, physically sick, because it turned my world upside down. It meant that the government was lying to us. It meant that it wasn't the way we thought, you know, government for the people, by the people, of the people, freedom of the press, freedom of speech. All these things were shattered just with the 9/11 lie, because it was a lie about something big. And all the institutions that we think are so hallowed and wonderful were actually not so good. They were in on the lie. So then, okay, that part was already done for me, looking into the Holocaust narrative, even though it went so much deeper, even though it was there since birth, basically, even though it was basically drip fed into us, into our very bloodstream, it was actually easier for me to see the lie in that one once I started to look. And I have to say, Ernst Zundel, the story about him and that particular video called Off Your Knees, Germany, that was one of the first things that I did look at once I started looking into this lie. And it was very big for me. That was a huge impact on me. And he still is, to this day, one of the great heroes for me, as Ursula Haverbeck is. interestingly, those two people, Ernst Zundel and Ursula Haverbeck, in my short little video, at the end of my short little video called Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust, I recommend to the viewer to look up three titles. And two of those were videos. One was about Ernst Zundel, the one I just spoke of, called Off Your Knees, Germany. And the other one was Ursula Haverbeck in about a 20-minute YouTube video that she had done after she had not received answers to that simple question that Michelle already outlined. Where did the crime take place? Where did it take place? She wrote repeatedly to every Jewish organization she could find and think of, to all levels of government, to chief justices. She wrote letters to everybody asking, where did this crime take place of the 6 million? And nobody answered her. So after 5 years of doing that, she decided, well, if there is no place where the crime took place, then it did not take place. As simple as that. And of course, she did lots and lots and lots more in-depth study. But that was the crux of it. If they cannot tell me where this crime took place, then it just simply did not take place. And that was the beginning of her troubles. And I don't remember what year that took place. But anyway, I think that answers your question, how I started to realize that this was a lie.
It certainly does. And your video was fantastic. I put it up on my Twitter page and it got, something like 400,000 or 500,000 views and very few negative comments. Obviously, you're going to get them everywhere you go, but it was tremendously positive comments. And again, I think it's because it breaks down that preconceived notion that people have in their minds that to deny that this was a historical event also somehow means that you are hateful and that you just want to kill people or that you wish the event happened. Or like there is this very heavy preconceived notion. It's not really about the historical event itself. It's about the character of the person questioning it. And I think, again, seeing someone like yourself who comes from this very honest, unbiased, very kind-hearted take really breaks that down. So to continue, go ahead, please.
I'll just add one more thing, because you had mentioned that it's harder for them to take a woman like Ursula Haverbeck, somebody who's very distinguished and whatnot, to turn her into something evil. But somehow the German press, I shouldn't say German press because they're owned by that cabal that we're not allowed to name lest we be called, yes, anti-Semitic. But they did manage to make her out to be, I remember the headlines would say Nazi Oma, so Oma is grandma in German, and Nazi, of course, is this highly weaponized term. So when the re-educated German people see these headlines, oh, Nazi Oma, this and that, they respond like the re-educated a la George Orwell style people are supposed to respond, like, ooh, that's a bad person. So they did manage to do that to Ursula Haverbeck.
Unfortunately so, and it's a terrible thing. And again, just your video is an example. I think, I don't know if it was intentional on your behalf, but playing the violin in the beginning, showing a sense of culture and calmness, perfect touch, because it just breaks that down, right?
If that's, it was very intentional.
Good. Well, it was very intelligent as well. In light of that, let's move to Lana. Let's hear your story about how you, I'm sure you were just boiling with hatred when you were researching these facts.
Oh, yes. I just gotta, is my mic fuzzy?
No, it sounds
Are
great.
You hearing? Okay. It's just fuzzy on my end. Let me just fix that.
It's a bit low.
All right. It's a bit low, huh? Okay. I'll see. I need the man in here to come fix it. Yeah, I remember sitting in school, like so many of us, seeing the pictures, having the Holocaust survivor come in, tell the story. And I just remember thinking, even as a little girl, something just didn't feel right. Something didn't sit right with me, just intuitively, even as a little girl. And then I just didn't think about it for many, many years. And then Henrik, when I was up in Sweden, he went, this was early days, and this was pretty brave when we just got together. He had to go out of town to film something for this documentary that he was working on. And he's like, here, watch some of these documentaries, like the Ernst Zundel trial, one third of the Holocaust, about the Fred Leuchter report, the truth about Auschwitz. I started watching these and just, I couldn't believe it. I was like, yeah, these are things I never even thought to ask, questions I never thought to ask, and it just made sense. And then I started listening to some of the outlandish, just crazy survivor stories, things that they were saying that just couldn't make sense, impossibilities of things that just sounded like fairy tales. And then hearing stories, it just would get more and more outlandish about, you know, roller coasters and masturbation machines and just some crazy stories. I'm like, okay, something is not adding up here. And as I was watching those documentaries and as I watched The Greatest Story Never Told, I'm sure you guys have seen that too, it kind of put a holistic picture for me together of a backdrop of what was happening in Germany at the time, what actually led up to, you know, this feeling of animosity towards the Jews. I didn't know that Judea declared war on Germany first. There was all these events that we don't learn about in school. Also that there was other people that were in camps, that there was lots of Germans that died, that there was the Dresden firebombing. It just kept coming and coming, all these events and things that I never, ever heard about. And then once I learned that people are imprisoned for questioning these things, it's the only event in history that you can't question. I hear people denying the Red Terror, that you know, Jewish Bolshevism didn't kill millions. My family was there. Some of my family was killed by those people. And so I started thinking, well, there's that saying, you know, who's the one group you can't criticize, or truth fears no investigation. So naturally you want to dig deeper and find out. And you discover all these little tidbits, and then the picture just started coming together for me. And then I was realizing how the Holocaust has been used as a weapon, not only against German people, but all European peoples, right? As a weapon for why we can't organize, for why nationalism for white people is bad, for why it's wrong and racist for us to say that we want babies that look like us, because that's what the Nazis did. Everything ends up being, well, that's what the Nazis did, you know? And then I was like, well, what did the Nazis do? What was their society like? What was National Socialism like? What did these people really believe? And I started researching. I was like, well, these are wholesome, healthy, normal people, not like we were taught. We don't learn anything about what was going on in Germany, what the people were thinking. We're just told that Hitler just put this spell on everyone and everyone was mind controlled and they just went along with what he was doing. And he was just this crazy person who murdered all these people. And then it was the truth about Auschwitz, seeing those rickety doors, you know, in these alleged gas chambers, learning about Zyklon B and typhus and how there was a lice problem and how, you know, they were shaving heads because they were trying to, you know, sterilize them to help them. All these things that I didn't know, as it added up, I was like, okay, this did not happen how they said it did. And I'm just pleased that it doesn't sound so kooky to talk about these things anymore, to question these things anymore. I mean, the floodgates have just opened up on X this year. It's so common for us to see people, you know, talking about the lies surrounding the Holocaust and World War II history, dismantling that. And like I said, it's been a powerful weapon. So it's important to air these things out, to talk about them from all perspectives. And I see how Jews are freaking out. They're lashing out. Yesterday was International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And more young people just don't care. They're tired of hearing about the Holocaust. We're tired of hearing about it, okay? We want to hear about other events in history. And as some of our countries, unfortunately, become, you know, less white, a lot of these non-whites, they don't care about the Holocaust. They're more obsessed with their own plight, their own people, what's happening. So the more the Jews are trying to push this, you know, laws about anti-Semitism and, oh no, we need to educate people about the Holocaust, it's actually doing the opposite. People are, well, they don't care. They don't care. And it's not such a taboo thing anymore. And I think that is a great thing moving forward, because the Holocaust has just been like this big, heavy thing just on top, not only German people, but us, used as an excuse constantly. Well, if you talk about that, that's going to lead to a Holocaust, or, you know, you want to kill 6 million Jews. No, I'm interested in the truth. Aren't we all? The truth at the end of the day. Why? Because the truth matters and the truth will set you free.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a weaponization of our altruism, right? They understand that we're empathetic people who care about other people and how they feel, and it's the perfect ploy to get us to feel bad and give them the benefit of the doubt on things. And You know, as you described it, when you think about this actual narrative that's laid out, that Hitler just one day woke up, he's like, "Hey, Jews suck," and everybody else in the country just followed him because he was so manipulative. It this is like literally like Jewish supervillain comic book type narrative, right? Like, oh yeah, he was Magneto, and he was, telepathically telling all the German people that Jews suck, and they all just fell for it. You know, it's really absurd, and it's actually, it's an insult on our intelligence that we're supposed to believe something that absurd. Realistically, it's just it's brazen to say the least. So, I think to touch on that other piece that you were mentioning about how everything, because this is the catalyst for everything always boils down to you're a Nazi, and then in essence, that means that if we let you say what you're saying, it's going to turn into the Holocaust, right? So you can't be against abortion, you can't be for straight marriage, you can't say that you want a white ethno state or that you want white sovereignty, because all of those things will inevitably end up leading to a Holocaust. That is really what the narrative boils down to. And I was just actually rereading Mein Kampf with my wife just this weekend, and reading through chapter two. I found it very interesting because Hitler kind of talks about exactly this propaganda piece that they use. And he talks about this idea of boiling everything down to one enemy, right? So again, if you're straight, you're a Nazi. If you're traditional, you're a Nazi. You're Christian, you're a Nazi. You're pagan, you're a Nazi, right? No matter what you do, if you advocate for anything that's somewhat European, somewhat white in essence, it just boils down to Nazism, and it's a really easy way to boil enemies down into one kind of fashion, right? And I think another tactic we can use, and I think it's already happening if you look on Twitter and everywhere else, that's kind of pushing these narratives, is to just start boiling everything down to it being Jewish when it's subversive or destructive, right? Transgenderism, oh, that's Jewish. Pedophilia, oh, that's Jewish. And just keep pushing it in that way. The same way that they call everything Nazi, we call everything Jewish, and we make that polarization as to what's good and bad. I think that's a really beneficial method for us moving forward. And it's true as well, when you talk
Yeah,
about
usually.
pedophilia or
There's that
transgender.
saying every single time,
Yes,
right?
it really is. I mean, it's very hard to find a case where it's not. So, to get back onto a topic a little bit here, in memory of Ursula Haverbeck and her struggle, Michelle, I'd like to go to you and hear some of your experience with Ursula. Maybe the best memory that you had with her and the best time that you spent with her, whether it's political or non-political. I'm very curious to hear.
Well, there's a couple of things that I'd like to mention, picking up on what you said and picking up what Lana said, actually, because about how it's difficult to demonize a woman like Ursula Haverbeck, a very elegant woman, a very eloquent woman, even as Monica points out, she's the Nazi grandmother and so on. But it's her conduct that matters. Conduct is mattered. And I just wanted to quote what she said. When we came out of the trial that she had where was it? Just for the moment, I can't think where it was, the name of the place. But the supporters held up a sign in front of the entrance to the district court, "Only the truth sets you free," as what has been said this evening. And she said, "Don't fight hate with hate." And I thought it was very relevant that she also said, that she said the epitome of the Plato saying was her own catchword, as it were. She said, "When," which is what he said, "when men speak ill of thee, live so as no one may believe them." And that, I think, is the secret of her success, and the secret that will be of our success eventually. Because I saw it even last night. I know I'm a little bit slightly going off topic, Zach, as you asked me, but you did also ask me how it was last night, because you were all rather keen to know what happened last night at the Goethe Institute in London. Because I did say that even though We're planned to be together tonight. I may not be able to beat, depending upon the outcome of how I'm, whether I'm smashed to pieces or not in going to the Goethe Institute. And it was...
For the Holocaust Memorial or Holocaust Remembrance Day, right?
It was for the Holocaust Remembrance Day. And apropos, so I've made a little note here so I don't forget little things that crop up, because it was interesting that Lana was talking about how the young people are bored with it. But I think also, Lana, that they are also, according to what the Auschwitz commemoration on television last night told us, that they're frightened mostly of the interest that the young people are enjoying with social media and your type of programs, the three mm-hmm. of you, because they are getting off piste, as it were. They are no longer relying upon the narrative of the Jewish press, which they themselves boast of owning. The people, and young people in particular, are now learning other things that about which we're interested. No, but just coming back now to last night, it was a film called Status and Terrain. And it was extremely boring, I have to tell you. It was 2 hours of extreme tedium, simply because the woman who, I don't know whether she was Jewish or not, I must say that she was very patient with my question, and she was very patient with, well, of course she avoided it, but nevertheless she was very patient, as opposed to the audience, with my question at the end. And the concept of the film was to show that in 1933, as Lana mentioned about the Judea declares an economic war, in 1933, this filmmaker was wishing, German filmmaker from East Berlin, she was wishing to show how, little by little, the concentration camps were being established within neighborhoods. And her point is that, therefore, the German people did know. And, of course, I straightway tried to point out that I didn't think it was that the people didn't know that the Jews were being removed from their locations. They were not saying that they didn't know that. What they were saying is that they didn't know about the gas chambers. And of course, I was immediately shouted down. And I thought I was going to be physically attacked, actually, by some of these women are really very scary, I have to tell you. But my point that I made, actually, the question that I put, because the reason I went along is because there was a question and answer session. So I thought this was an opportunity to ask a question.
Ask the right questions, yes.
Yeah. So I said to her, well, you know, there was that big headline in the Daily Express in London in 1933, which said Judea, that means all Jews, declare an economic war on Germany. Now, this comes from the big Jews in America, like Chaim Weizmann, who by doing so have indicted all Jews worldwide, whether they wanted to be part of that boycott or not, which means that they themselves had indicted all of their Jewish people, and thereby it was not exceptionally cruel, as I happened to say in Germany, and nearly went to prison for 5 years for saying so, is because all countries, when a group of people act within, like a state within a state, and they brag that they are going to boycott the economics of that country, naturally, that country, whoever it is, must put those potential, what we might call fifth columnists, those saboteurs potentially, into internment camps. It's what the British did, it's what the Americans did. It is what all countries do, and therefore it was not exceptionally cruel of the Germans to have to do so. Of course, as Monica was mentioning, I happened to go to the Dresden rally in 2018. And the perhaps it's interesting for viewers to realize that I'd made a film about the Dresden Holocaust, 1945, An Apology to Germany is Due, because we have access to the British Archive, which talk about how those who worked for Churchill bragged that their intention was to target civilians. It's now called moral bombing, but actually it was an intention to Holocaust, to literally burn alive those citizens in Dresden. And so I made a film about it. But I had not actually been to Dresden I had been to Dresden years ago, but not in relation to these commemorations. So I went along with Richard Edmonds, the late, great Richard Edmonds, who always called the Allies equals all lies, which I think is a wonderful phrase that we should all use to describe what we are currently living under.
What was the phrase again? Can you say the phrase again?
The Allies equals all lies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so he spoke German, and so I went along with him. He was in my film. And I wasn't intending to speak. I don't speak German, but I just wanted to turn up, as it were. And when we were, before the rally began, which I must set the scene, it was 300 of our kind of people, 300 of the Antifa screaming and yelling and making a tremendous cacophony, and thousands of police. I mean, the police, the vans, there were at least 40 vans, I think I counted, with any number of police in them. It was an enormous situation there. And before it began, Richard and I were chatting about something in English, and a German woman overheard. It wasn't what we said, it was just the fact that she said that you English have no right to be here. And of course, this caused a little bit of a commotion because the Germans around felt that they had to apologize to me, and so on. And so the chap who was running it was called Gerd Ittner, who wasn't allowed to speak because he'd been to prison, but he was allowed to organize this rally. And when he mentioned that this was going on, a lot of people had been to my place and knew me. They said, well, we want to hear from her. So he just simply handed me the microphone. I had no intention of speaking at all. And so I wanted to say that I understood why the German woman said that to us as English people, because we were standing on what you might call hallowed ground. We were standing where people's feet in 1945 had melted into the hot, burning hot tarmac, and they had been literally, like torches, burnt alive. That is a Holocaust. A Holocaust is not a cremation. And so I said I understood and spoke for 10 minutes, and I did say that I didn't think it was exceptionally cruel of the Germans to intern them. Well, you know, the rally was immediately closed down, and of course I was arrested, and there was to be a trial, and so on. I won't go into all of that, but I did say that the Germans weren't cruel to put them into internment camps. I said they weren't exceptionally cruel, and in Germany, paragraph 130, of which Ursula Haverbeck was subject for 23 years, as it happens, you cannot say that the Germans were not exceptionally cruel. It's a law that the Germans must be considered exceptionally cruel racially. Racially, that's the law. And that law exists when the people never voted for the basic law in this federal republic. And so Germany does not have its sovereignty. And one of the reasons why they threw in the towel 2 days before my trial, in which I was to be given 5 or 10 years, by the way, for that 10-minute speech, is because, unlike Ursula and a lot of our valiant people, they don't have the idiotic celebrity notoriety that I have. And it's that which rescued me. The stuff that has always been something of an embarrassment to me I've been a model all my life, but I've never really liked it, as it were. You know, I've had because I've had other careers, I've rather regarded the one career that has been my most substantiated one is the most embarrassing one, because I've been an academic, I've been a university lecturer, I've been a landscape designer, and I've had many careers, academic and other careers, and so my notoriety as an actress, a beauty queen, and all these kind of things have always been a bit of an embarrassment to me, but they are the thing that saved me from being in prison right now, this minute, because eventually they were afraid that my notoriety would cause the international press to take an interest in my case. And it would be over the four trials, as Monica would understand very well, there are four trials. It goes to one, the Amtsgericht, and then the next one, the land, and then the next one, and finally it goes to the Court of Human Rights. So there would have been four trials in which my case would have come up. And what's the ex-beauty queen up to now? You see, it's absurd. Ex-beauty queens never die. They want to
well,
know
now it all makes sense.
Look now. How's the old witch look now? 78, she must be, you know, and so on. And it's that extraordinary thing that, and if I can just sort of a little bit conclude by telling you a joke. I'm not very good at telling a joke, Zach. I really am. But I think you will forgive me because the punchline is so wonderful and so absolutely apt. There's a classroom filled with international boys, young boys. And the teacher says, I'm going to give a prize to the boy who can tell me who's the most important man that ever lived. And the Italian boy says, this and this is, I'm not very good at a joke, so I have to cut it very short. Suddenly, Moisha says, I know, teacher, it was Jesus Christ. He was the most important man. The teacher said, Moisha, you have won the prize. But she said, I'm a little puzzled. How is it that a little Jewish boy should think Jesus is the most important? And he said, well, in my heart, it's Moses, but business is business. And I think that is the explanation for why they 2 days before my trial, after 2.5 years of preparation, they actually flew in the tub. Because though they never want to speak about David Irving, they don't want to speak about Ursula Haverbeck, they don't want to speak out in the trial. Once they've pariahed these people, the idea is not to speak about them, not to give them the oxygen, as they say, of publicity. But what they feared with me is there would be other aspects of me that would cause them to say, well, we should not give her the oxygen, but business is business. We're going to sell a lot of newspapers if we talk about this ex-beauty queen and et cetera, et cetera.
And that would not be good for them.
Trials, they would have to say, but what is her crime? And her crime would have been exposing the lunacy of the German courts and how people are being put in prison for asking questions, for putting up stickers, for doing things that are just so minor and so a part of what we understand as democracy that it would have ridiculed. It would have caused the ridicule of the so-called German judiciary. And this was too dangerous for the people to risk allowing. And this is what we need to expose. And I think when Zach says we should be saying these are Jewish things, this is very important because it's the allies, the allies, the people who are writing all of these laws and controlling us. Who are they? Who are they? And in the case of Britain, we had one person who said it was Sir Alan Duncan who bravely said that there's too much Israel lobby influence in our governments. Well, of course, we don't hear another word from him, except when I go out on rallies to hold up this as my placard. And of course, you have AIPAC in America, who control. So we do know They brag themselves when they say they own Hollywood, they own the media and so on. So we should be brave enough, as Ursula was certainly the most magnificent of them, in my view, because she had such a dignity in the way she did it. And I think that is extremely important, that we conduct ourselves in a way that is fitting for what Robert Forreston said was the idea of revisionism. It's a method. It's a scientific method. And we should ourselves conduct ourselves in a restrained and civil manner. And just concluding by coming back to last night at the Goethe Institute, the audience there saw that these people were screaming at me, and I was not screaming at them. And this was a very important lesson for the young people who were there, who were from other countries, who were clearly not German and not Jewish, to learn, because they were there to learn German, because the film's subtitle is in German. They could see how revisionists conduct themselves, as opposed to the tyrannical people who are trying to shut down normal historical debate and rational argument. And of course, I've got too much to say, Zach, but I would like to just conclude my wonderful statement by commemorating the late, great Robert Forreston's right-hand man who died recently. As Yvonne, Robert Forreston's sister, recently remarked, very sadly, fate has been very unkind to our revisionists in the last couple of months because we've lost so many of them. We've lost Ursula in November. We lost Jürgen Graf. This is the film I made about Jürgen Graf, if you can see that there, which I called Real History Karamakazis. He has died a few months ago. And William Nichols, who was the right-hand man and one of the three of us, who were on the committee for the Robert Forreston International Prize that we awarded for the first time in 2019 to Ursula Haverback. She was our first awardee. And William Nichols was the one who first alerted me to the guidelines for teaching about the Holocaust in schools. It was in Stockholm 2000, and it still exists. And I'm just from the back of my DVD about jailing opinions, I'd like to just read that sentence, because I think it's the killer sentence that everyone needs to hear. It's something that is absolutely a revelation. And it says, and I'm quoting from page 11 of it, of the guidelines for teaching about the Holocaust in schools, and it says, "Care should be taken not to give a platform for deniers or seek to disprove the denier's position through normal historical debate and rational argument." End quote. Now, if that doesn't tell our viewers what this is a religion, which some people have called Holocaustianity. It replaced Christianity. And here it is, clear. You must teach this era of exceptionalism that is set in stone as a religion, as a faith. You must not involve normal historical debate or rational argument. And this is what we are up against. And somehow or other, we have to help people over the fear, this for two millennia, of being able to confront these liars. Even Trump hasn't managed to do that yet. Well, we'll see.
No, but Elon the other day, I know he appeared before AFD, right? And he had said that Germany needs to move beyond their Nazi guilt. And I, of course, you know, we have things to say about guilt for what, you know. But And man, the Jewish community was just up in arms. It is clear. Like, they were like, no, this is dangerous. They want Germans and they want all Europeans to have guilt forever. They don't want to let this thing go. They want it to be thousands of years from now that they can use this as a sledgehammer over people's heads. But it's not working. And it is a religion. What was it? Yesterday I saw at Auschwitz, they gathered. There was elites and royalty gathering in Auschwitz. They put together this huge tent. And they were having a cocktail.
All bowing down.
There. Yes, it was like a Mecca visit. And it was Rabbi Shmuel, this dodgy character. He made a comment. He said, it kind of feels like Disneyland. These pink and purple lights. And I'm like, precisely. Yes. It's a theme park,
And every one of those people having to bow individually. We have to see individually the countries. And then they gave a huge applause for Zelensky. Zelensky, who is a Khazarian Jew.
Yeah.
I mean, how the Ukrainians have fallen for this and how our own people have fallen. Some of our people have fallen for Zelensky. I mean, truly, Zelensky has said 2 years ago, it's on the internet, he said that he wants to make of the Ukraine a big Israel. Can you imagine? That's all we need. And they applauded him, of course.
Well, they haven't done any favors. This war hasn't done any favors for Israel's PR or for Jewish people's PR. Yes. And so they don't know when to quit, right? That's usually how it works.
Well, and, I think it's unfortunate, too, that the pundits, even the Palestine, pro-Palestine pundits, they think they're being clever when they say that Israel is behaving like Nazis.
Oh,
well, it's very important to understand that Adolf Hitler was age 8. In 1897, when Theodor Herzl said, we will get our Jewish state by, quote, disappearing the indigenous poor of Palestine. And that is precisely what Netanyahu and his crowd are doing. He's literally disappearing these people. And there's only one picture on the cabinet we see. When we see them in cabinet there, we see only one picture on the wall, and that's Herzl. And so I think it's interesting, though, perhaps, we'll see, when Trump starts this little campaign that's been going on for a very long time, that he's behaving as if it's new, that why don't we move these people out to other areas in the Arab world? Why don't, now he knows perfectly well that that's not going to happen, because the other countries don't want it. And the Palestinians, who are magnificent, because they are role model people. They want their land. They want their ethnicity. They are proud of it. Those women, those magnificent women, they're like the Trümmerfrau, which I can't pronounce, Monica, I can't pronounce Trümmerfrau. But, those ladies who, at the end of the war, picked up all the bricks. Oh. The bricks. Well, the Palestinian women, in the middle of starving and being bombed, and they are still washing their clothes and putting them out on the line. I mean, can you
but then
imagine?
But for some reason, when they come over to the West, then they hate on us and they just pick up all the anti-white talking points.
Wouldn't you hate us, Malala? I hate us.
I wish they would figure out, though, that our countries are overrun by people that are not us, that there are subversive forces in control, that it's not me, it's not you. We don't want these wars. Most of us don't want this war.
Yes, but it's our leaders who are, and we have a democracy, you see, so those people assume that because we have a democracy, that we have voted for this. And so our leaders, who are absolutely treacherous beyond belief, have colluded with killing these people for the last, carrying out Herzl's plan. Especially the British are very responsible with the Balfour Declaration to eradicate these people. And they don't want to be in our countries. They want, the Palestinians I'm speaking of, they want to be, they say, they're traipsing back from to northern Gaza, and they are being interviewed and they're saying, we don't want to go anywhere, we want to stay in our country.
I'm going to just follow up on some things that you said earlier. I mean, there's lots one I could follow up on just this part of the conversation. ultimately, I think that the goal is to, again, bring lots and lots and lots of the refugees into our lands, which, yes, again, furthers the displacement, sure, of our white race. But anyway, just back to something you said earlier about the German people not knowing about the gas chambers. I mean, very, very specific memory for me when I was a teenager, after I was learning about these horrors in school, and I think I was probably around 14, 15 years of age, it would have been junior high school, and as a little German Canadian girl, I'm traumatized by what I'm learning in social studies class about the soap, the lampshades, and the shrunken heads, and the evil Nazis who gassed 6 million Jews.
They're still teaching that in the schools now, as a matter of fact.
So anyway, when I went home and I'm, you know, really upset, and I lash out at the person closest to me, my mother, and I said, why didn't you do something to stop all these horrors? She didn't say, oh no, those things didn't happen. No, she didn't do that. What she let me speak, and then she answered very calmly, very quietly. She says, Monica, we just did not know. And then she added, we knew there were work camps. We knew there were concentration camps. We knew there were work camps, but we didn't know about killing. Like, we didn't know about gas chambers until much later.
1970s, right? Yeah.
She didn't give me this precise year, but exactly that. So she, I'm sure, I mean, she's not around anymore to ask, but I'm sure that she came to believe those lies, just like most other Germans who were traumatized by the war came to believe those lies themselves. But much later, those, you know, she says, well, we just didn't know. We didn't know. We knew there were work camps. We knew there were concentration camps. So circling back to Ursula Haverbeck, maybe we could talk a little bit about what is it that enabled her to not fall for those lies. Ursula Haverbeck, by the way, was born exactly the same year as my mother, 1928. My mother was a little bit earlier because she was born in February and Ursula in November of 1928. So I feel, even through that, I feel a kinship with Ursula Haverbeck because my mother was born in Berlin and grew up in Berlin until the war years. They fled with just a knapsack on their backs and ended up on the property of a distant relation in Bavaria. So that's then where I got to know my maternal grandparents, was in Bavaria, beautiful, beautiful place where they then lived after the war. But they came from Berlin and had to flee with just the knapsack on their back with some family treasures, which would have included the silverware. And I still have some of those beautiful old spoons and real silver that was passed down. That was their most valuable possessions. And they put them in their knapsacks along probably with some clothing or whatever. But anyway, Ursula Haverbeck. So her husband, I think, was a historian. I don't know that much about her history. And Ursula and her husband, who died years earlier than Ursula did, but they had some kind of an organization in Germany.
Yes, Collegium Humanum, it was called.
Okay.
And I think Ursula was a bit like Lana as describing how she came to, it was the curiosity, the idea that you, you know, what you've been told makes you wonder a little bit. That's what Lana said, and that I think would explain a little bit of the background of Ursula, because unfortunately Ursula, though described as a grandmother, unfortunately was not a grandmother. She did not have any children. Heaven knows what the circumstance might have been. I mean, there was so much terror for women, which was written about by the late great, another one who's gone recently, was Tom Mike, I used to call him, Goodrich, who wrote The Hellstorm. He was the one who wrote so graphically about what these poor German women experienced. Heaven knows what the atmosphere must have been around Ursula, who would have been there at that time.
I'll tell you something about my mother. She never, ever expected that she would get married and have children. Do you know why? Because most of the men of her age were dead from the war. So she fully expected to do something independently. Actually, she went into medical school. She was going to take over her father's medical practice. And at med school, she met my father, who was 8.5 years older than her. And my father was alive partly because he was studying medicine during the war years. And so he would alternate a semester at university to complete the medical studies with a semester on the front as a medic. So that kind of helped him out, I guess you could say, because he was less likely to be shot and killed as a medic, helping those who were shot and injured and whatnot.
Unlike in Palestine at the moment, which is the one, they're actually the ones who are in the targeted, the medics.
So anyway, I don't know. Yeah, okay. Anyway, so I don't know if Ursula married late in life. I have no idea about those circumstances, if she married a man similar age or if it just those years passed her by, which Lana, you spoke so beautifully about the other day on a different broadcast about, you know, that can happen so easily. Those years can pass us by of bearing children. And we, yeah, the German people at that time, like my mother said, she fully did not expect to be in the situation of meeting a man and having a family because of so many men were dead of that age group. And then, you know, in the subsequent generation, we were all bamboozled with this notion that, you know, the population bomb by that guy named Paul Ehrlich. I wonder what tribe he is from. And we all have been subjected to all of that propaganda about, you know, there's too many of us. And who was that targeted at? That was targeted at us, the white race. But I digress. But we talked about Ursula Haverbeck herself not having any grandchildren because she didn't have any children, which I'm sad to hear that. I did not know that, actually. And I know that there was a lot of confusion after she died, that people thought she died in prison. No, she did not die in prison. She was at home, in her own home, and she had people with her always.
She was only not in prison, actually, because of her magnificent lawyer, which is our lawyer, too.
Yeah, my lawyer, too.
Wonderful,
so they kept trying to put her in prison. Right. They kept trying, but they didn't actually spend time in jail.
I'm going to clarify that.
Yes, she did, Lana. Very much so. Yeah. Yes, she was there for 2.5 years in one stretch. And at the time, that's why we say that she was still battling at the very end, because Hamburg court was still deliberating on how long they were going to bring her back and put her back in prison.
Yes.
And so I say that she was on the front line, even though she was at home.
They were trying up until the day she died to put her back in jail. Yes. And so again, yes. I'll just I've seen so many different people's thoughts and ideas, and partly it's to blame on the mainstream media in Germany when they put all these headlines every time it went through one of these court levels, one of her many, many, many cases, because there were many charges against Ursula Haverbeck through the years. And like you said, she was being persecuted and followed for 23 years. Okay, so many times, and then, you know, there would be one court level that finds her guilty, but then it would be appealed. And contrary to what they did to myself and Alfred, where they basically just kidnap you and throw you in jail because they say, oh, you're going to run away or whatever, they didn't do that to Ursula Haverbeck. There were appeals and there were more appeals. And while these appeals were going on, she wasn't physically in jail. But then she went to jail. They actually threw her in for 2.5 years, like you say. That began in 2018, because I know that she was put into jail while I was in jail over there. And so 2018 until 2020, then she came out 12 days. I believe it was 12 days, very close to that. Correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm off by a day or two. But 12 days later, she was in court again, you know, not for new charges, but old charges that were just still grinding their way through. And there were so many court dates and just the procedures. It was very, very trying on her. By the time she died last November, she was 96 years old. So,
well, I've got an account actually here of how they were trying, how they were bringing her from one court to another, and it was going to take 5 days. She was to receive a penalty of 10 months in November. The system was causing her to go to take 5 days for her journey from one court to another, during which she would be subjected to all sorts of body searches. And what they were trying to do was to exhaust this woman in her 90s to give her an extremely difficult journey. Were difficult for anybody, particularly for an I mean, it was just the cruelty of the federal of state of Germany that they would subject a woman for what is her crime? For speech, for thoughts, for querying.
I mean,
what I wish
after she died, I wish there would have been, you know, 1,000 more older women who like came out in support and said, no, we're asking these same questions. Like, that's what needs to happen as a follow up. So that prisoners.
Well, Lana, there was also there were two ex constitutional court judges, if you remember, Hassemer and Hoffman Rehm. And they came out, I think it was in 2008, I put them in a film that I made, where they said the Holocaust denial law should be repealed. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, I wrote to them, I said, if only you had another 100 in the same way that you're suggesting another 100 women, Lana, if 100 ex-judges had backed up these two constitutional judges, they could have said, well, it's not our idea, it's their idea, because
that a lot of these,
everybody's too frightened.
These boomers and is there more of the older generation left still that they can do in their older years? This is something they can do that can drastically help their grandchildren and their great grandchildren moving forward in Germany, especially if
so important. So important. You're right. The people who have no job to lose anymore. It is extremely important that, you know, the retired folks come out and say, yeah, this is nonsense. Just something that I was started to say earlier and I didn't complete it because my own mind got sidetracked from what I was saying. But part of the reason there was so much confusion about Ursula Haverbeck, when many people everywhere thought she was in jail physically again and again, was because the mainstream media, every time there was one of these court cases and the appeal was lost, the newspapers were always screaming Nazi Oma was sentenced to this and that and the other thing every time. And so yes, she's sentenced, but it didn't mean she was actually physically thrown in jail again, but always this hammering on her. But of course, you know, that's what people then thought, well, she's sentenced to so and so many years or so and so many months. Time and time again, these headlines were screaming this about the Nazi Oma and that she's, you know, sentenced to time in jail again. And so, of course, it's understandable that people thought she was going to jail many, many times. Not to diminish what actually was going on, because all that persecution and all those court cases, I mean, that was basically what her life then was revolving around, was fighting these court cases and the stress of it all
the
time.
And she loved it. And she loved it. She loved it. She absolutely loved it. When Wolfram Narat wanted to keep her out of prison and get her off the hook, no. She wanted, but I wanted to ask Lana and Zach, because I think Monica probably did. Did you, in your upbringing, know this one of the Brothers Grimm cautionary tales of the musicians of Bremen?
I've
never heard of the Bruce, you would, of course, of Bremen, but no. I'd never heard of the musicians of Bremen. Had you, Lana or Zach? No.
I'll just say it. Die Bremer Stadtmusikanten. And I had a little book. I had a book in German. It was one of my favorite childhood books that my mother would read to me.
I interpret it, because it's very relevant to what we've just been talking about with the older retired people. The concept of the story is, because I'm writing a book about these things, the concept of the because my house is on the Brothers Grimm fairy tale trail in Germany, you see.
Nice.
And it's where the Red Riding Hood story was discovered and the cautionary tale. So I'm particularly interested in it. And of course, I went to Bremen with Manfred Roeder, whose house I bought. And the idea is, as I've discovered, but as I interpret it, is that these animals were thrown out by their owners. I think it's the donkey, because they're old, you see, they're thrown out. The donkey's thrown out, the dog's thrown out.
No
the
longer
rooster's
useful
thrown out,
to work.
And the cat's
no longer
thrown
useful.
Out. Yeah, they're no longer useful, you see. And so they're, you know, and so they meet, as it happens, on the road to Bremen. And they say to each other, why don't we all join together and become musicians? We'll be singers, you see. And en route, they come across a house. And they want to stay for the night. When they look in the window, they see that robbers are occupying the house. So at night, they climb upon the top of, that's the symbol of this Bremen. You've got the donkey, I think it's the donkey, the dog, the rooster, and the cat, or something like that. And they climb upon each other's back, and at night, the robbers are seeing through the window a set of eight eyes. And these animals decide they will sing together, and the cacophony of the Eeyore of the donkey and the rooster and all the sounds are so terrifying for the rooster, for the with all these eyes and so on, that the robbers run away. And so here is an example of when the retired, useless people who are animals or whatever have been thrown
they become
away,
very useful.
When they get together and work in coordination with each other,
yes,
they can be bloody frightening.
Yes.
And that is the concept that that we can learn from. That's what I take.
I love it.
Since
it.
I'm old and 78, I rather like the idea.
Well, you look fabulous. You're still going strong. And I think that's a very important message to share, because maybe a lot of older people, they just feel they're not useful anymore, or they can't be useful anymore. No, we need you. We need you out there talking. Just
but we need to
truth,
get
right?
together, you see.
Get together
we've
and
got
do
to get
it.
Together.
The power in numbers. Yes, power in numbers,
yes.
Right?
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah,
but we've got to do it in such a way that we don't join the way that our enemy behaves and emulate our enemy. That is not that is not the way, I think. We have the classical four inseparable virtues, and I think that's the way we should go in the classical way, where wisdom in terms of the Hellenic tradition meant with a scientific attitude, a la revisionism. And so we should rely upon that way of conducting our case, as opposed to just being bitchy and
I've never seen
nasty,
that. To be honest, I've never met a revisionist who isn't classy and who isn't a likable person in their personal life.
Well, no, I really thank, indirectly, I thank Richard Wagner, the composer. Directly, I thank the British World War II historian David Irving, because of those of knowing of these people, I have come across the most remarkable people that and got to know them personally. I simply cannot understand how it was that coming from being merely the model and not being involved in anything to do with politics, I had an unworldly upbringing, that I should have the luck, the extraordinary luck, to come across these magnificent people. You cannot find a more magnificent lot of people than those in the revisionist movement.
That's
and
true.
They are so different. They are so different. And yet they have one quality that is more valuable, I think, than anything else, and that is those virtues of the Hellenic tradition. So we can all, whatever religion people are or what their religion they aren't, we can all gather together under the umbrella of the four inseparable classical virtues upon which we all rely.
Yes.
Yeah, one other thing I'd like to touch on as well with this concept. Lana said, you know, we needed 100 more old women to stand up and in defense of Ursula. And I think, number one, the reason it unfortunately probably didn't happen is because, as Michelle was saying earlier, the Jews do a media blackout. Unless it's absolutely necessary to cover you, they won't cover you. So unfortunately, there's probably just so many out there that don't know. But I think that is one thing that we really need to hammer home on is when you look in history, these Jews who, you know, persecute people and drag them down and slander them and things like this, these are the people, you know, that we revere as some of the greatest people in history, right? And I think that's because there is this concept of justice in our people, in our ethos, right? Where justice is a very valuable thing to us. You know, it's not so much for Jews. It's certainly not. It's probably the polar opposite. But this is the mistake that Jews have always made historically, and it's one that we need to learn to capitalize on. And I think a show like this very much does that. But they make a martyr out of people, and that is what our people naturally – that's how we kind of – adhese to somebody very closely is when they gain that martyr status. It's what naturally brings more eyes to them, more excitement comes around these people. You see it with figures like Jesus Christ. You see it with Adolf Hitler. And even, you know, if you want to, I don't even know if I believe that Trump was really shot in the ear, but that was a big martyring scheme, whether he was actually shot or not, one way or the other. The media
was going to be at some point. So, you know,
the media was smart enough to capitalize on it and make a martyr out of the guy, right? They get that big picture of him throwing his fist in the air like he's some kind of defiant, you know, you can't stop me, right? And it makes a martyr out of him. When people see, they're out to try to kill him, it hardens them to him. They want to be around him. They want to defend him naturally. And I think that's our duty, is we need to capitalize on these things and really, like we are today, display what they've done to a woman like Ursula Haverbeck, who in her 90s, when most people are living this self-interested golden years of, you know, living on their retirement money and not doing anything and just kind of kicking up and enjoying life, she was struggling to the bitter end on behalf of the truth and on behalf of what she thought was of the utmost importance. And it was these literal scumbags who were throwing her in and out of court systems, prisons. I mean, this is repulsive. No one would consider this acceptable if it happened to anybody else for any other reason. I mean, there are people that look at a brazen old woman who was a murderer, and they actually feel bad for her in a court system. Yet this woman is questioning a historical event, and she's being treated like the absolute bottom of the barrel in humanity. And I think that's something we absolutely need to capitalize on and show people just how poorly they will treat anyone. They would execute a toddler if they were questioning the Holocaust or their narratives. And there is no qualms in that for these people.
Well, you know, you did ask me a question earlier, and perhaps I could answer it now, in terms of what was a most memorable occasion that I experienced with Ursula Haverbeck. And it was when she came to the Frankfurt Book Fair. I can't remember the date of that particularly, but she came with a bevy of her followers, her female followers. She certainly did have some magnificent women, medical doctors, all sorts of women. They were a very nice group of people, and I'm still a little bit in contact with some of them. But I didn't know she was going there. I was tipped off about this book fair by a person whose name I cannot mention, but he often tips me off about all sorts of things, which I follow on from. And there was at this book fair, a very big book fair, Monica will know about it, they had on that particular year as their guest of honor the Chinese. And there was a big forum there in the book fair, huge event it is, in a very big building. in which there was a chance to speak at this forum, question and answer. And the idea was, how can we help the Chinese with their human rights? So I got up and said, well, we can show them an example. We could set them an example. We could release all of our scientists and historians and revisionists and skeptics out of the German prisons, who are simply querying one area of history that for some reason has exceptionalism. And then I saw that Ursula's and her wonderful bevy of women suddenly turned up and held up their posters. And this was created quite an impact on the audience and the people there, which didn't cause us any problem. Actually, brought a lot of people to look at the case without fear. And somehow or other, we have to figure out a way of causing people to take an interest in what we're talking about, and to do it fearlessly. You know, it's numbers. People respond with less fear if there are numbers. And so we need to build a sense of greater numbers. And as I said at my the speech, that impromptu speech in Dresden, that our enemy have the money to, and the abilities, because that's what they concentrate their skills upon. Their skills are in advertising, are their main skills, and money to facilitate this. And so they know every one of us. They will be watching us at this very moment. We know this. But we, worldwide, do not know each other. We are vast. If we knew how many of our people are like us, worldwide, we're enormous. They know, the enemy know, how vast we are, and they try to keep us from knowing this. So they don't like places like my place in Germany, where I will have international guests, because the last thing they want is to have this international connection, which you are facilitating at this very moment, Zach. You are facilitating, because we know that there are many people from all sorts of countries who are watching us right now, and will watch us when you repeat this, presumably this live broadcast. And so we need to, and that is what we could see was fearful yesterday. When one watched that Auschwitz commemoration, they said that we are fearful of the young people watching social media, because they're not watching their narrative, which they've controlled for so many decades.
And it's become socially acceptable. Just go on X this year. Yes. It's just a huge difference as far as talking about the Holocaust and Jewish power and, you know, them attacking Gaza. That's a huge part of, like, thank you. You opened the door for that, you know.
Yeah.
Well, yes, you know, you see all the university students on the campuses worldwide have been brave enough to stand up for what's going on in Palestine. They can see that this is unjust and this is inhumane. And they've been given the idea that Israel is the worst, the only democracy in the Middle East, and it's wonderful, and it's the Jews are violin players and they're so innocent. And now they can see exactly that this is Judaism made manifest in Israel. And they don't like it. And they are risking their jobs, their careers worldwide. Those university campus students will not forget what they stood for, and they won't be allowed to forget either. But there are a lot of them. They're vast, and because they were vast, they stood up and knew that they had the power to do it, because they couldn't put them all in prison. And so we have a very good example in the youth. Not only could we, as the older ones, like myself, try to garner more of the retired people, we can take heart with the young people that their empathy is so great with what they can see is unjust, and a literal Holocaust happening in Palestine. And those people are our role models. They are fighting for their own tribe, their own ethnicities, their own pride in what they are, and they in their own land. And everyone in their own land should be taking an interest in that, because we need our tribes, our races, our cultures. And this globalization of mixing this all up is clearly doesn't work, and it's not in anybody's interest.
Hear, hear to the young people, because the young people seem to get it a lot quicker than we took a long time to figure it all out. But anyway, I just want to underline something else that you said about this isolation that the Jews like to make us feel like we are just alone and just a lone nutcase, just a lone wolf, just alone. There's all this language around that. As part of the psychological warfare, they also artificially lower the view counts on videos that show truth. That we know that actually Alfred proved it when he was still on, had his YouTube channel. There was ample proof that these numbers would get manipulated. Like in the evening, just before bed, you check that the view count is, you know, I don't know, 150,000. The next morning you wake up and you say, oh, the view count is only 10,000. Oh, gee, it got less view counts overnight. Like, how did that happen? So they do manipulate because they know very well the psychology of how we are a social creature. We are very influenced by what we think everybody else, what the herd is thinking. And so then when you do step out of line, they really work on that isolation and make everybody else think that this is just a nutcase. This is just a total crazy person, a kook, don't associate with them. That is part of the weaponized, it's one of the mechanics of their psychological warfare against us, is to make us feel like we are alone. So it is very important for us to understand that they try to make us sound like we're the only one that think this. I mean, I remember very viscerally the reaction I had when I first opened up a web page about the Holocaust. Remember I said earlier that I resisted for a while to look. Once I looked, the first thing I opened was a website called what's called Holocaust something 101, Holocaust, oh, what was it called? A huge website. Holocaust deprogramming course. That was it. Holocaust deprogramming course. Maybe it had a 101 on it.com. It doesn't exist exactly in that form anymore, but there are other websites that have probably, you know, used a lot of that material. What I discovered was that there was a ton of material on there. So that was the first thing that entered my head to put me into a state of mind thinking, oh, it's not just one, you know, nutty, whoops, I just lost my ear things here, but one nutcase like Ernst Zundel, like they try to make him out. I mean, here I was in Canada at the time that those trials took place, and so the way they painted him in the mainstream media with the headlines was he's just, this one lone nutcase. So it's not just one Ernst Zundel who thinks that the Holocaust didn't happen. There is so much material here that I thought already that had an impact on me to know, oh, it's more than one person and it's more than one source and it's more than one article on this. There's more than one piece of evidence. There's more than one, right? That had an impact on me already. So yes, you betcha, they use that as one of their tools against us. Our enemy knows us very well. They know us better than we know us. I often say that, you know, it's not a coincidence that the psychology and psychiatry professions are overwhelmingly disproportionately Jewish people in those professions, you know, compared to their population. Disproportionate number of them are in those professions where the psychology, they understand our minds very well. And they know that that's one of the things that impacts us a lot. What does everybody else think?
Well, you know, I think it might be a good idea if we since we're talking of women, and especially older women, not that I suppose some of these people must be older now, but, you know, there's Carolyn Jaeger. She interviewed me years ago. She's a wonderful
I remember her.
American
I interviewed
German.
Her many years ago.
There
yeah.
was these ladies, the patriotic Danes. I've not had much contact with them recently, but there's these. Then there was
back in the days of DVDs.
Diana Spingola. Yeah.
You
know,
I remember
you ladies
too.
May
yes.
know more about it.
Yes.
But there's just three women that I can think of just offhand. And of course, the one person that I think we can, not that she would like us to name a name actually, but she, the sister, Yvonne, the sister of Robert Faurisson. Now there's an unsung heroine who was steadfast with her of the work that she did. Who else can I think of? Well, there's Ingrid Ringman for a start, for another one. Who else did I think of? There are many, many women that I can think of, and I'm sure you would be able to think of more women. We need to perhaps assemble this as some sort, in some way or other, to show
Nancy
people
Hitt.
How many
I'll just mention one, Nancy Hitt. She's been
yes,
working, fighting the good fight for
yes.
decades.
And of course, Linda, with Linda and John Mortal. Linda was a wonderful, and still is a wonderful activist. Gosh, there are lots of women. And I think if we all put our thoughts to that, we could probably compile a good 50, you know, or more. So that we encourage people by showing that there are safety in numbers and that there's honor in numbers as well. That you...
Another
you
one that you know...
Band, you join a band of distinguished brothers, as it were.
Another one that you know, Michelle, is Grace Ikki-Oyama, who also on that theme
yes,
of
yes,
the world...
Japanese.
The world
Japanese
owes...
One, yes. Very
let
good,
me just
yes.
say just something you mentioned earlier about an apology to Germany. She did this wonderful impromptu 5-minute speech in a home in Vancouver when we were having a meeting with the Truth and Justice for German Society. And she said the world owes Germany an apology. And that was filmed. So it's on our I think on our Odyssey, maybe also on our BitChute channel, the Truth and Justice for German Society. The world owes Germany an apology. And that was Grace Ikki-Oyama. And she's been working for decades on these things. Kind of started out as a translator. And she realized, gee, this translation is not quite right. That's going on. Something about the World War II. And she realized the reason the translation wasn't right, and this was something into Japanese, I guess, was because the translator was so far out of their possibility of thought to that whatever the speaker was speaking, that they translated incorrectly. And so she understood what was being spoken because she knows many languages, and she said to the speaker afterwards, that wasn't properly translated and this is what it should have been. And then she ended up being the translator after that and has also attended many trials around the world.
Well, she was actually the person who worked with his name just momentarily escapes me. They made him, the two of the Japanese, his name will come to me in a moment. He and Manfred Roeder wrote a manifesto, and it was translated into any number of languages. And that's how I came to know about Grace Ecke, because she was still promoting, his name escapes me at the moment.
Let me,
and she still is.
Before I go, I just want to say, I know I do have to leave, but I just want to say, yes, we should thank all those women that have gone before us and everyone that's laid the the groundwork for us to be able to discuss these things. And I have to say, I know a lot of younger women, and I don't know one younger woman who doesn't know the things that we are talking about now. So that's just showing you how quick that this is spreading, the truth is passing on. And those women go on to have babies, and they tell their children the truth about what happened. They can't stop us from telling our children things, can they?
Well,
they may
there's
try.
A good reason.
They may try, but they can't.
Well, Lana, there's a good reason why the Jews have always made women the teachers and promoting of their concepts, you see, because the women are the ones who educate the young children. And and so it is the women who actually are the ones who civilize our countries, our nations, always. I'm very opposed to the current fashion at the moment of how our women are being persuaded to wear a ring through their nose and to expose the thong, their underwear, so that not only do they draw attention to their buttocks, but they are drawing attention to their anus. And for some reason, brother, imagine that this is freedom, whereas it's titillating and indignity that even a queer wouldn't. So our women are necessary for causing us, our civilizations, to be sustained.
And I think that's why women like us who have been out on the front lines, you know, I've lost bank accounts and credit cards, banned from everything except for X. I've been defamed like crazy from New York Times to CNN to every. They were really doing a number on me there for several years. And I think it's because I was a woman outspoken about these things, and they find it, they were finding it threatening that women were discussing these things because it does soften it. They admit that,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
It gets other women to pay attention. It normalizes it. It, like Zach was saying at the beginning of the show, you know, it's much harder to attack, you know, younger women or a grandmother talking about
it's
these
the soft
things.
Diplomacy, you see, Lana. It's the soft diplomacy.
And they're terrified
diplomacy.
Of that, right?
Yeah. So,
bravo, Lana.
I remember the younger woman, Eva Leone, who made the most anti-Semitic video ever. She was a big one. The media tried to do a big hit piece on her. She was, what, like 14 or 15? And she had that news reporter trying to guilt trip her into feeling bad about talking about Jews. It's just so shameful. Well, look, ladies, we're coming up on the two-hour mark, and I know Lana actually stayed a little bit longer than she was supposed to. Thank you. I really appreciate that. So let's go around. We'll just go to conclusions. I just want everyone to have a chance to promote anything that they're doing, their websites, shows, anything like that. So, Lana, because you did stay a little longer than you were supposed to, please go ahead first, and then feel free to chime out if you have to.
Everything is over. We're not on the dark corners of the internet. Redice.tv, you can find all our links there. Of course, I'm on X. We do live streams. We do interviews. We do little videos. We do all kinds of stuff. So redice.tv, or you can just find my X under Lana Loctev.
Okay, thank you, Lana. I appreciate
you
joining us.
It's been
a
blast. And thank you, Michelle and Monica. And we'll be talking soon, too.
Before you leave, Lana, because you might just leave, I just want to say bravo to you and all the work you do.
Absolutely.
And also your
husband. Absolutely.
It's absolutely fantastic. I've admired your work for a long, long time. And like I mentioned the other day, Red Ice, that was one of those things that figured prominently in one of those guardian angels that told me a message in Jasper that when I just needed it so badly, and just the fact that they were listening to Red Ice told me all I needed to know. It means they knew and they were with me. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
And what a beautiful, iconic girl she is as well. My goodness.
Absolutely.
All right, ladies. Gorgeous. Have a wonderful evening. We'll talk later.
Alrighty, Monica. Bye. We'll go to you next if you want to give any kind of conclusions, any things that you want to promote. I know you have something very special coming up next Saturday. If you want to promote that,
yeah. Oh yeah, and I think my guest. Oh, he's somebody familiar right here. My next guest on The Flip Side with Monica will be Zach here of Logos Revealed. And I really look forward to that. It's a weekly show, 1 hour long on Republic Broadcasting Network, which is at republicbroadcasting.org. All the archives are there. So freespeechmonica.com is my website. I occasionally post an article there, and Monica with a K. And the other website that I have quite a lot of involvement in, because I'm involved with this organization called the Truth and Justice for Germans Society. So that website is truthandjusticeforgermans.com, all one word, all spelled out. And I have an Odyssey channel, and I'm on Gab and Facebook, and it's pretty easy to find me just with my name. I think that's it, what I wanted to say in terms of where people can find me. And I have enjoyed today so very much. I'm really glad that we worked it out technically, and that we were able to all come together. It was four time zones, four generations, you could say, and three countries were represented here today. And I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Zach, for your diligence and patience and setting it up and making it all happen. And I'm so glad that Michelle was able to join us, and Lana too, who's already departed. But that would be it for my last comments.
Of course, Monica. Go ahead, sorry.
I would certainly echo that. I mean, I think Zach has been extremely patient with the three women who were very gabby, very gabby, especially some of us.
It's certainly my pleasure.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and of course, I had a little chuckle when you said that you and your wife had been reading Mein Kampf, you know. I think Adolf Hitler would be very pleased, because, in fact, it was wedding gifts, I think. It was, yes, a wedding gift intended for young couples. So I thought that was rather amusing to know that. But on a more serious note, really, although I think that's a serious enough note, frankly. But I think we could do no better with our viewers to encourage them to try and see if they can either find someone to buy and donate the Holocaust Encyclopedia written by the German chemist Germar Rudolph, because I think it's extremely valuable for people to understand in great detail where he is able to contradict the magical gas chamber that works emotionally but not scientifically, and all the other aspects of this story. Because as we've made clear in this broadcast, the Holocaust hoax and its fairy tale of the 6 million and the gas chamber and the eyewitnesses to all sorts of absurdities really is the sword and shield and the cudgel that is stopping anyone from making any comment, as Zach has pointed out, on any topic that doesn't suit those who are controlling our narrative. Yeah. And luckily, so in order to get that encyclopedia, you would need to look up Germar Rudolph and to find out how to get a hold of it. It's about 100
Actually, pounds. You just put in holocaustencyclopedia.com, will get you, yes, there.
And it's, yeah, about £100 or so. That's why I say you might want to donate it to the reference libraries in your schools, in your universities, everywhere, to make it available. Because I think this is one way of causing people to have a chance to see the other side of this debate, which is forbidden and which is controlling us. And of course, the other arm of this is to take an interest in what's going on in Palestine, because that Jerusalem is the biggest, most potent, as I would put it, advertising logo on the planet. Whoever owns Jerusalem owns the idea to swindle-speak people into myth-addledom, where they believe somehow that these people are to be feared, and that somehow they are God's gift or whatever it is that is causing people to be so fearful of querying and addressing and identifying the people who are preventing us from behaving like rational, reasonable people. And the first step that Donald Trump has made is to identify that there is only two sexes. There's male and there's female. And thank goodness this means that all the children who are being subjected to lunacy in schools from age four, who are being asked if they are male, whether they want to be a boy or a girl, and in consequence, without their parental permission, can be subject to all sorts of drugs and concepts which will ruin their sex lives and cause us to be even more reduced in our racial numbers, which is the idea behind it all, as well as driving this all insane. So at least he's made one step in the right direction. Let's see what else he's going to do.
I say just take the children out of school.
Yes.
Alrighty, well.
At least you take it.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead.
That's all. Okay. Well, I think with that, we can close up if that was everything that you guys had that you wanted to add. Thank you very much to the audience for tuning in today. I appreciate everybody that shared the post over on Twitter. I saw a lot of people did that. And again, thank you to the wonderful ladies who came on the show. It was an absolute pleasure to host the lot of you. With that said, folks, you guys can catch the show. We'll be live tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern. We're going to have Ian Malcolm on for a little chat on our usual Stu Peters Network show. And I think we're going to close out today's show now. I have a couple calls I got to make, so I got to get rolling. But thank you all for watching, and we'll see you guys tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern. I appreciate it very much.
No surrender. Hearts high.